When the cost of our current behavior is more than we're willing to pay, we will change quickly and easily. Those are the words that a mentor of mine spoke to me back in the mid-90s when I lived in California. I had met this man, actually my ex-wife, who was not yet my ex-wife, got me to attend a relationship workshop he was conducting. His real specialty was addictions, but he also dealt with relationships, person to person, as well as person to substances. And when he said that, I thought, that's interesting. And much like I do with everything else, when somebody tells me something, rather than accept it, I kick into my Doubting Thomas state and apply it to my own experiences to see if, in fact, this is true for me. And I recommend that you do the same thing with anything you hear from me or anybody else for that matter. I think there's a great deal of value in thinking for ourselves. And if not thinking for yourself is your current behavior, it might be interesting to weigh out the costs of that. To my way of thinking, there's a cost-benefit ratio, there's a cost-benefit state, there's a cost-benefit balance or imbalance to pretty much everything that we're doing. And you can consider to see if that's true. One of the things that occurs to me is that most of the time, we're unaware of the costs, and we can even be unaware of the benefits. We're just acting out of habit. We're doing the same thing we've always done or what seems to be normal. And so when we start to look at what it is we're doing from this standpoint, it can give us a greater degree of awareness, a greater degree of understanding, and with that additional information, we can improve our abilities as decision makers. Years ago, close to 10 years actually, right after 9/11, that my wife and I went to Ireland for the very first time. We were staying in bed and breakfast most of the time, but the particular day we were going to check into a hotel in Kilkenny, Ireland. So, beautiful hotel in the middle of Kilkenny, and as we're getting in the elevator, we are now going down to the first floor. We're going to have a Guinness or something in the bar. And there's a woman with a huge container, like one of those postal boxes that you'd see a post person or somebody carrying a large amount of mail into the office, one of those filled with cigarettes. And so we got into a conversation. I did talk to her about her need to, she might want to cut back a little bit. And after a few chuckles, I asked her what she was doing. She said, "I just finished a smoking cessation class. And up a floor in a conference room, and these are the cigarettes, individual cigarettes, packs of cigarettes, carton of cigarettes, that I collected from the attendees." I said, "Well, that's interesting. Tell me the theory behind this. What approach do you take?" She said, "Have you ever heard of Alan Carr? A-L-L-E-N Carr, C-A-R-R. No, never have. And she briefly told me the story that Alan Carr was an Englishman, smoked about 3 packs of cigarettes a day, and then dawned on him that he wanted to quit. He could see the cost of that, right? That would, you would think, that's pretty easy to see, the cost of smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day. It wouldn't take a great deal of analysis. But she mentioned that he has a book out, and you could buy it in a bookstore. I said, "Oh, that's interesting. I'd like to check this out." She said that their success rate in a 4-hour class was about between 85 and 90%. And those people that didn't quit smoking after those 4 hours were welcome to attend another class free of charge. And she said, we get almost everybody through it after they go through it a second time. I thought, wow, that's cool. next day, we're in another place spending the night, and this is going to be in a bed and breakfast. And I, as soon as we arrived there, I went to find a bookstore, and I found Alan Carr's book about quitting smoking. And I read through it, and it was interesting. It was very interesting. I'll go into that in more detail in a few minutes. But when you think of the costs of a current behavior, and I'm going to talk in terms today of costs of what we're doing, and then if there's some behavior that we haven't started but we'd like to, the costs and benefits related to that behavior that we want to start, the costs of not starting, for instance. So costs can be looked at in a variety of ways, and I'm going to suggest a few of them, but I think there's got to be more than just the ones that I'm going to outline here. Now, we think in terms of costs of money, but there are other ways to look at it besides money, although money is a very important way to look at it because most of us can relate to a monetary or a financial cost. If you look at the cost of a behavior, what we're paying directly is one thing. That would be the money that we're paying, the time that we're paying, the energy that we're paying, to do this particular activity. We're also, there's a cost there of not being able to use that money, time, or energy for another activity because we are investing it in the first activity. So there is a lost opportunity cost that's looked at in business. That loss of opportunity is a very high cost sometimes. And so those are the things we're talking about that are direct here. But then you could take these costs in all those different ways and extend them into the future. The cost today is one thing. That's just today within this 24-hour period. But if we move past that and get into, next week, next year, next month, 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road, what other costs are likely to accrue to me for this particular behavior? So while we're incurring the cost in the present and in the future, we are also giving up some of the benefits, that those opportunities, and some of the things that we would have had if we weren't paying for this particular behavior. It's very easy to think of cigarette smoking, and for years this was looked upon as an individual activity. So the cost of cigarette smoking, for instance, was pretty limited to the person who was smoking a cigarette. Not so, because then we got into the idea of secondhand smoke and the air quality and so on. If it were only an individual activity, then there would be no problem with the guy next to you smoking a pack of cigarette in a half hour if it didn't bother us. But it does bother the person sitting next to him. So in many states of the union, the law prohibiting smoking in bars and restaurants was passed. I happen to have lived in California when that law was passed in California. I don't know if it was the first state, but it was amazing. It was difficult to go to a restaurant because right next to you was a person could be at the next table smoking. And it's like, I feel like I'm in the middle of an ashtray. And consequently, it was unpleasant. And once that ban went into effect, the quality of a dining experience was amazing. So you could just see the cost-benefit in that simple description. If we look at this cost-benefit state or ratio or balance or imbalance, then we're going to be able to understand what it is we're paying, what it is we're losing, what it is we're gaining, and then, however that weighs out, we're going to be in a position much more easily to make a change, if, in fact, a change is warranted. Going into the costs, real and imagined, going into the benefits, real and imagined, makes that pattern, makes that situation truer, more accurate. And so there's a couple of ways to do that, which I will go into in a few minutes. In 1970, I was stationed in California when I was a second lieutenant in the United States Army. I was attending Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California, learning Spanish. And during that time, I was a smoker. I had smoked on and off since I was probably 10 years old. My mother was a smoker, my father was an intermittent smoker, and I was a smoker. So, smoked more or less on and off throughout high school, throughout college, and throughout this first couple of years in the military. In Fort Ord seemed to be a cloud hanging over it, coming in the clouds coming in over the Pacific Ocean and hanging there, and the same in Monterey. It would burn off in that kind of marine layer, as it's called, June gloom and so on. That would burn off during the day, but I found it very difficult to breathe. I had fractured a nose in an automobile accident when I was a teenager, so I was experiencing some complications apparently because of that. But smoking, too, is the tissue in a person's respiratory system, nasal passages, those tissues got to be screaming for relief, and they're trying to do everything they can to protect themselves from this onslaught of toxic, unnatural kind of things that are being bombarded at it. And so it was during this time in language school that I decided to quit smoking. And this is what happened for me. I was coming out of the gym. I'd work out at the gym three nights a week after class, and I would run during the lunch times 3 days a week. And so now I'm coming out of the gym, and I am coughing and hacking and so on. And all of a sudden, it dawns on me the cost that I'm experiencing. I had stains on my hands from holding a cigarette, nicotine stains, yellow stains on one hand, and this burning in from my belly button up to my mouth from smoking. And I went, wow, what a cost, what a cost. And then it dawned on me what the benefit, supposed benefit was, and where that image came from. The image came when I was a little boy, I'm thinking 8 or 10 years old. There were 9 people in my family, my parents and 7 children. So now, whenever the house was basically empty, it was so wonderful. And I'm sure my siblings felt the same way whenever that occurred, even though it was rare. I was laying on the floor reading an encyclopedia or something, and I turn around and I'm looking at my mother, who is reading a newspaper, sitting in a kind of a rocking chair, recliner kind of thing, the most comfortable chair in that room of the house. And it was, I'm thinking 3:30 or something in the afternoon, and there's just this most beautiful billow of smoke from her Camel cigarette that she had just took a puff of. Was exhaled. It was just a beautiful plume. And I associated peace, tranquility, calm with that image. Well, here I was in California in 1970, coughing and saying, that was a lie. That was a misunderstanding. A little boy didn't understand what he was seeing. What was calm is my mother was reading and I was reading, and there were only 2 of us in the house, and it wasn't a ruckus, it wasn't Grand Central Station going on. It wasn't the cigarette. It was just because it was 2 of us and it was quiet, but that's not how I imaged it as a child. And so that powerful image that cigarettes equal peace is a powerful one. Another image that was connected to it is rebelliousness, being cool. And I think that rebelliousness is a very common factor for a lot of kids to start smoking. So when I realized this, how I had been duped by my own interpretation of cigarette smoking, seeing the benefit but not the cost, and now all of a sudden I realize I must smell like an ashtray, my fingers are stained, I'm spending a lot of money. I, in fact, was really annoyed at that point in language school. Some of my second lieutenant buddies smoked cigarettes. They didn't buy them. They only smoked them. Well, I always bought them because I always wanted to have them. And so now they'd be all bumming cigarettes off me all the time. Oh, give me a cigarette, Tom. Give me a cigarette, Tom. Give me a cigarette, Tom. So why don't you guys buy them? Nah, just give me a cigarette, Tom. That was really quite annoying to me, because now I'm trying to be the logistics officer for a whole group of people whose bad habits rivaled my own. That was really unpleasant. That was another cost, being responsible to supply other people. I have a wife and two children. I don't need to be supplying bachelor second lieutenants with cigarettes. I started to mount the costs on my mind of what was here and the benefits. That list of benefits didn't exist. Even though it was Monterey, and it, as I mentioned, the marine layer would come in and it would get cold and so on, nothing cold like the Northeast, like I was familiar with in the winter. However, even cold mornings in Monterey, when you can recognize this is cold, before I could start a car, I'd have to start a cigarette. Before I could even turn the ignition, I'd have to light a cigarette. I went, wow, the cost here is the cost of my freedom. I am a slave. I'm a slave to this activity. This thing dominates my life. What are you going to do now? Well, oh, hold on. I got to go have a cigarette, right? And you can see these people. I see it now in, you know, if I go to a metropolitan area, you see people on a cold, rainy, even snowy day huddled outside of a building smoking a cigarette on a break. If you ask them, what are you doing? Smoking a cigarette. Why? I like to. Hello. You like to stand out in the cold smoking a cigarette? Nah, I don't think so. I don't think so. But we do it because we haven't changed our relationship with this harmful action, this behavior. We haven't really looked at its costs. We haven't looked at its benefits. And if they're false, which they often are, we would need to be able to identify that. A couple of years later, I was in guerrilla warfare school in Colombia, South America. Couple of hours down the mountain from Bogota. Very stressful. Probably lost 25 or 30 pounds over the course of that program. And it was really designed to convince us as students. It was an international course. I was the 8th American ever to go through it. And they were trying to convince us that there was no such thing as possible, that we could do anything we decided to do. We could endure and persist. And so that was the whole point of this program, is to learn tactics, and that, in fact, if we were running down the enemy in the jungles or the forests or the hills or the mountains, anywhere in the world, if we never stopped, we would always catch them. And they proved that point. Nothing was impossible. But during that time, some of the other officers from Colombia would offer me cigarettes, and I'd decline, but at the end, when I was really, really depleted, and normally I'm about 200 pounds, I was down into the 160s at that point, is like, I would take anything if it would give me any kind of relief or boost, and pretty soon I'm smoking cigarettes, Marlboros, which they immediately started to bum from me once I started to buy them. I switched to the Piel Roja, which is red skin, which is the lowest quality tobacco you could buy in Colombia. No self-respecting cigarette smoker would smoke that nasty thing, but I did. And then nobody would bum them. They'd ask for a cigarette, I'd offer it, and they'd go, oh, no thank you. They'd walk away. It didn't. I saw there was a benefit. There was no benefit, but it gave me something to do, I suppose, which is really the benefit of that. When I was getting out of the Army, I made a decision I was going to quit smoking, and this is now several years later. I got out of the Army in December of 1974, and I had made a determination that I was going to quit smoking once I got to the end of my Army cigarettes, because the cost was too high. Get this. Up to this point, I had been paying about 10 to 15 cents a pack. 10 to 15 cents a pack. And the last Army cigarettes I bought were 20 cents a pack. I paid $2 a carton. I was offended at the high price. I said, this is ridiculous. I'm not going to pay that high price. I'm quitting. So when I ran out of Army cigarettes in January 1975, I stopped smoking. So I had set a deadline as to when this was going to occur and the condition, and when I couldn't find any cigarettes, and believe me, I tried to find them. I looked high and low throughout the car. I'm looking everywhere and couldn't find them. Quit smoking. A day later, I found the pack of cigarettes in the car. I went, no. I looked yesterday. You weren't here. This is not Army cigarette. And handed them to my then wife, who still smoked. And I quit smoking and haven't smoked a cigarette since then. I think no need for me to be in relationship with a cigarette. So if we have a behavior that we want to stop, I think we can look at it. And what kind of behaviors? Could be smoking, could be drinking, could be overeating, could be watching too much television, could be overworking, could be however we spend our time and energy and our money and our intellectual capital. Any way that we do that is got a cost-benefit condition to it. If you invest in watching television, you could look at it and go, what's this costing me and how am I benefiting? And you could weigh it out and make a determination. You're going to, okay, it is costing me. However, the benefits outweigh the cost, so I'm going to continue doing it. There's no problem there. As long as we're doing things mindfully as compared to habitually or robotically, I think it's cool. But I would say this. If we're doing something that is obviously a harmful action, it is because we have not gained an understanding of the cost-benefit condition of that particular activity. If we're doing something that we know to be harmful and we continue to do it and we don't analyze it, it's because we don't understand the cost and benefits. And so looking at the benefits is really one of the earliest steps that you can take. I mean, obviously you can determine what behavior we're talking about. That's step one, and your determination to analyze it. And based upon your analysis, to either continue it or stop it, that would be the first step. Then you can start looking at either the cost or the benefits. But taking a look at the benefits is really a very helpful thing to do. You can list them out on a piece of paper, and I would certainly recommend this kind of an approach because we don't typically look at this stuff. We just assume, or we close our eyes to it, or put our head in the sand, if you will, and just do it. So if we were to list those benefits, I'll put that in quotes because a lot of these are going to show up as being false, much like my cigarette smoking experience and the conclusion I made about that when I was a child. And so now if you would just turn around and say, okay, what benefits does this activity have? What are the benefits to this? I would say you could probably use this framework, and there are going to be other ways to do it just than the way I'm describing it now, is needs. Let me look at it from the benefit regarding my needs. How does it help my survival, my usefulness, my freedom? How does it help my love, my ability to give and get love? How does it help or support my identity? So survival, freedom, usefulness, love, identity. How does it help my need to be right? How does it support me in my need to get approval or look good? Those seven. And you go, okay. You can imagine, just from the cigarette smoking, if you have that in your experience space, many people do, is the need for freedom. This is that rebelliousness that I talked about. And if there's peer pressure, hey, I want to be cool. I need this identity, and I need the approval of this group of people. And so if they're smoking and I smoke, then I'm birds of a feather and I'll belong. And now it's cool that I'm one of them. And so you can see how love fits into that, a sense of belonging, and so on. If you got all of that wrapped up in the harmful action, that's a powerful combination that's going on. It appears that that's a strong glue of us to that behavior. But we can remake decisions about that. We can also look at it from the emotional states. The 10 I use, just because it's convenient, shame, apathy, grief, fear, lust, anger, pride, courageousness, acceptance, and peace. You can look at it, and as a little boy, right, I attached peace to that activity of smoking a cigarette, and then I attached an attitude of anger to it, rebelliousness, I'm trying to stop something, trying to be cool, and if I really thought I was cool, that I would be in a state of pride. And so it's all of this stuff going on. And if we're coming at this, and I hear people in the state of fear when it comes time to quit smoking, I don't want the discomfort. And so, you know, they stay glued to something because they're afraid of what it's going to feel like when they change their relationship to a substance or an activity. I think we can look at the benefits not only from the emotional state point of view, as well as the needs point of view, but also in terms of our management of energy. And I'll express it like this. We manage matter, you know, solid stuff. We manage energy, thoughts and emotions and invisible stuff. We manage space, right? Space is that geography in our homes or in our cars or this field around us. And we manage time. What are the benefits to our management of matter, energy, space, and time when we participate in this activity? It's pretty easy to see that when you start looking at that, and this is really what Alan Carr does in his four-hour sessions, and he does it in his book, too, about quitting smoking, is he has people describe the benefits that they're getting from smoking cigarettes. People say, oh, you know, it relaxes me. Oh, I think better and other things like that. And he immediately refutes them by giving them reality, scientifically valid information resulting in, whoa, you're breathing air, and then all of a sudden, now you're breathing burning vegetation. And you think that that's what the cells of your body are looking for, that's what your brain is looking for, smoke and toxic dust in that smoke as compared to fresh air. And he goes through that, and all of a sudden these benefits that people attached to this basic thing, this basic activity, I'm like, oh. And you go one by one, whatever, 10, 15, 20 different benefits that his class would talk about, he would go one by one and diffuse them. So he's crossing off this list of benefits, because they're not benefits, they're misunderstandings. They haven't been thoroughly considered by these folks, and consequently they're using them to bolster an activity. Well, I'm benefiting, and no, you're not. And so that is one of the first orders of business, is to be able to look at the benefits we believe we're getting from a given situation. And when we realize it's not true, it's false, now all of a sudden we can start making a different decision. I just flashed as I was talking on TV commercials, right? You look at a pharmaceutical ad on television, they say, oh, here are the benefits. You'll be smiling when you walk into the office. Oh, your wife will be smiling. You'll be smiling. You'll be happy. You'll be socially comfortable, whatever the drug they happen to be pushing at that moment. That's a benefit, and give you a lot of great imagery of happy women, happy men, happy everybody. Everybody's so happy because of this. That's the benefit. Oh, by the way, here's the small print. This is your arms and legs fall off, and you're going to be dangerous, and don't take this if you stand upright or you breathe or you don't, right? And they go into the small print of the costs. May cause death, it may cause seizures, it's like, wow, give us some images, guys. Give us some images of all these nasty costs instead of only giving us images of the benefits that you are hyping. Give us some images regarding the costs. They don't do that, of course, because I would say most Americans would go, no, I'm not willing to pay that price. But because the way they deliver the costs in that scenario is so minimized, people can't actually judge effectively the costs and the benefits. It's designed to distort it and to create an illusion. We've been tricked. It's basically like three-card Monte on the street corner of New York. It's a scam. If we look at a behavior and see that it doesn't serve us, but we're connected to it, I think, much like I did, came across that early image, and this is what we do in the healing codes and other energy modalities, is consciously or subconsciously, we can change the relationship to that image that keeps us glued to an activity that clearly isn't beneficial to us. If we start looking at the costs of a given activity, we can look at present time costs, we can look at future costs, and as I mentioned before, we can look at cost of those people around us. We're the teachers. If we have small children, we're the teachers. We are the teachers. We're teaching our children, not by what we say, but by what we do. We're going to demonstrate to them a certain behavior, and they're going to learn from that behavior. They are going to pay the costs of what we've taught them. And that's been exhibited with, you know, prenatal drinking and smoking and other things, as well as after the child is born and demonstration of harmful behaviors. It is very expensive in a lot of cases. So we can use the same frameworks of needs, survival, freedom, usefulness, love, identity, need to be right, need to look good / get approval. And we can look at those 10 emotional states: shame, apathy, grief, fear, lust, anger, pride, courageousness, acceptance, and peace, and managing energy, matter, energy, space, and time. And then, if we really crank in money costs, that's very helpful to a lot of people to recognize how much they're spending. It's one, I don't know what a carton of cigarette goes for today, but it's significant. Let's say it's $5. I think it's actually much more than that. Say, I'll just use the figure of $7.50. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. $7.50. You go, okay, it's only $7.50. It is only $7.50 right then. However, if you do it again before the end of the week, or you do it once a week, every week, or if you do it more than once a week, every week, you can start 52 weeks, how many years, and you start totaling this money that is flowing out. It's flowing out. That's a huge cost. That money is not buying books, not buying developmental tools like programs and courses and tapes. It's not buying good food. It's not buying clothing. It's not buying meaningful stuff for yourself or your families. It is going outward. And at the end of somebody's life, you look, wow, you could have bought a house with that money you spent on cigarettes. What do you got for it? Emphysema, lung cancer, iron lung, inability to walk. That's expensive. That's an expensive cost. I think every result of every activity has to fall into either category of the category of costs or the category of benefits. If we analyze the costs and benefits of a particular activity that we want to stop, and we discover that the benefits that we've had up to this point are false, we're going to have a more accurate cost-benefit picture. And then from that place, we'll know what we're paying, we'll know what we're gaining, and simply by changing the energy of that, we're going to be in a much better place to make a decision. Then our relationship with that activity, that substance, can change quickly and easily. One of the challenges I've noticed with people quitting smoking is, and this was true for me 2 years ago, is what do I do with all the hands I now have? This having something in your hands is a pretty habit-forming physical ritual. And I'd watch people with cigarettes. I had a friend back on Long Island. I watched what he would go through when he would get a pack of cigarettes. He would tamp it down and tamp it down in a certain routine. Tamp, tamp, tamp. This is the whole pack, you know, to kind of tighten up the tobacco and the cigarettes. And then he would go through this ritual of unwrapping them. And he would only buy hard, what is it? The hard top box that top flipped open. It's been a long time, but I don't remember that. And so he would go through this whole routine and lighting up the ritual and what he did with his hands and what he did afterwards and putting it in an ashtray and how he flicked it, how often. And if you watch the physical activity of a smoker next time you're out, it's just unbelievable what they do. It's, what do we do with this, all this physical energy? I think a lot of the value of that activity is it gives people something to do with their hands. And when you take it away, it's like, uh-oh, what do I do? What do I do? That's when they need worry beads or rosary beads or a pen or something else, or stones to have in their hands so they can play with it. I think we can use what I just described to stop a behavior, or certainly to analyze it to see if it's worth keeping or stopping or changing. But I think we can do the same thing with behaviors that we want to begin, but we don't. We want to start this, but we procrastinate. We procrastinate. Why do we procrastinate? I will bet that most procrastination is based on the overestimation of the possible costs and an underestimation of the benefits, so we don't do it. And this is likely to be just the reverse of the situation where we have a harmful habit. In that case, with a harmful action, the costs are underestimated and the benefits are overestimated. The name of the game here is to accurately understand what the costs are and what the benefits are of situations, so we can make a decision based upon that understanding. That's the name of the game. That's really what we want to do. I think this is true. You want to express yourself more. You want to cause desirable effects in your life, in the lives of others. You want to be useful. You want to be valuable. You want your survival, freedom, usefulness, love, identity, needs to be satisfied. You need to be right, just like me. You need to look good and get approval, just like me, just like everybody else. If we can satisfy those needs more effectively, our ability to express our potential, to create good, not only in our lives, in the lives of our family, but in the lives of other people whom we serve, everything is so much better off. I think we can look at what we're doing and what we're not doing, analyze it, and this is why I sound like it was a complicated process. It's not. It could be done in just a matter of minutes on any given area. Cost-benefit analysis. Benjamin Franklin would refer to that as a list of the pros on one side and the cons on the other. Why you'd want to do it and why you wouldn't want to do it. Used in sales closing techniques 101 for a couple of hundred years now. We can look at the underlying cost-benefit state, because that is actually dictating our level of action or inaction. It is what is controlling whether we express ourselves or hold ourselves back. It is whether we blossom and flourish or we keep ourselves, our light, hidden under a bushel. When we can identify how we're processing information and make a wiser choice, more in keeping with whatever values we each have individually. There's no one set of values that one person says, no, you must adhere to this set of values. A lot of people try to do that. But part of freedom is you getting to choose your own values and how you want to express. By using this little tool of identifying the costs and the benefits of taking action or not taking action, can really serve us. Because when we know the price that we're paying for something, and if we determine that that price is more than we're willing to pay, we will change quickly and easily. By seeing the true relationship of costs and benefits, we will know what it is we want to do, and it can happen so much easier. We take our foot off the brake, put our foot on the gas pedal if we want to change. Or If it's not substantiated by our analysis, we continue doing exactly what we're doing, and we're good to go. And we could stop fretting about it, and stop holding off about it, and stop second-guessing ourselves, and then focus on what it is we want to create, analyze the costs and benefits of that, and then make a decision to do it or not, as we wish. I would like to end this service with a prayer. Father God, Mother God, Christ, the Creator in connection to all that is, thank you for all of our blessings. Thank you for all of our good. We ask, in this benediction, your help in connecting to you, the real energy that we're seeking in all of our actions, harmful, neutral, and beneficial. We're seeking you. Help us to understand that. And that would be, to me, a better idea of how to stay on track as we move forward. Thank you. It is so. Amen.